It was a beautiful sunny day when Lord Louis Mountbatten and seven others boarded his boat to go out and enjoy the weather and check on some lobster pots. Unbeknownst to him, hiding in the engine of his boat, was a 50-pound radio-controlled bomb, primed and ready to go. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as two sides waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Lord Louis Mountbatten was perhaps the highest profile member of the royal family to be assassinated, and his death made headlines across the world. The nature in which he was assassinated, as well as the other victims who died alongside him, has led to this being one of the most infamous attacks to occur during the Troubles. A quick note before we begin, this podcast deals with some violent subject matter, which may not be suitable for a younger audience. Louis Mountbatten was born in Windsor on June 25th, 1900. His parents were German aristocrats who shared close links to the British royal family. Mountbatten's great-grandmother was Queen Victoria, and he was also the uncle of Prince Philip, and the two were very close. Mountbatten's father held the title of First Sea Lord of the United Kingdom's Royal Navy, but was forced to resign from his post during the outbreak of World War I amidst a wave of anti-German sentiment in the United Kingdom. The family name was originally Battenberg, but his father changed this name to Mountbatten in 1917, amidst the anti-German sentiment. It was also around this time that other members of the royal family also changed their names to more English-sounding names. And this is how the name Windsor came to be. Louis Mountbatten joined the Royal Naval College when he was 14 and went on to pursue a career in the Navy. He served extensively during World War II and was in command of the HMS Kelly in 1941 when it was sunk in the Mediterranean, which resulted in the deaths of half the crew. Winston Churchill was very fond of Mountbatten and promoted him to Chief of Combined Operations in 1941. While at this post, he planned the hugely successful Bruneval Raid. He was also behind the Dieppe Raid in August 1942, which was a failure and resulted in the deaths of over 60% of the Allies involved. Despite the failure of this raid, Mountbatten claimed that the lessons learned in Dieppe were necessary and helped with the planning of the Normandy invasion, which was to occur 2 years later, though this claim is disputed by a number of military historians. Mountbatten said, "I have no doubt that the Battle of Normandy was won on the beaches of Dieppe. For every man who died in Dieppe, at least 10 more must have been spared in Normandy in 1944. As a leader, Mountbatten often had some ideas which were seen as less than practical. He put a lot of effort into the construction of an aircraft carrier which was to be made entirely out of pycrete, which is a combination of ice and sawdust. Churchill was interested, but soon realised that the construction of one such carrier would cost more than the construction of a whole fleet of regular aircraft carriers, and the project was soon shelved." In 1943, Churchill appointed him to the position of Supreme Allied Commander in the Southeast Asia Command, where he oversaw the recapture of Burma, which is now called Myanmar, from Japan. 2 years later, Mountbatten received the Japanese surrender in Singapore. In 1947, Mountbatten became the last Viceroy of India, where he was tasked with facilitating the British withdrawal from the country. He was instructed to withdraw in a prompt manner and without having to split up the country, but soon realised that this was an impossible task and began working on planning for partition, which would lead to the creation of Pakistan. This upset a number of leaders in India, and in particular Gandhi, who campaigned for a united country. Partition occurred on the 15th of August 1947. Mountbatten returned to the Navy in 1953 and eventually retired in 1965. Speaking about getting older and his eventual death, Mountbatten said, "Now I've come to the end of my useful life. There's no point in being alive forever and merely becoming a burden to other people. So I don't mind now really when it comes, as long as it's a reasonably peaceful and a satisfying sort of death." Mullaghmore is a small town situated on the west coast of the Republic of Ireland. Though it is only 17 miles from the Northern Irish border, it was a relatively peaceful town and didn't see a lot of the violence that was going on in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Cassibon Castle sits just outside the town of Mullaghmore and was used as a hunting lodge and summer home for British aristocrats. During the Irish Rebellion, the castle was taken over and used as a barracks for the Free State Army. It was then inherited by Mountbatten's wife, Lady Edwina, in 1950. Lord Mountbatten loved the west coast of Ireland, and after his retirement, Mountbatten and his family would spend their summers there. For Mountbatten, it was a place to escape the life of being a royal, where he could live a normal life and spend time on the beach with his family, or bring them out on his beloved boat, Shadow 5. His boat was painted in the colours of an admiral's barge, which was a very specific shade of green. There were none other like it in Mullaghmore, which made for a very obvious target. The local people didn't mind the royals visiting, and some even welcomed the employment that came to the area when Mountbatten arrived. In 1979, he hired a local boy, 15-year-old Paul Maxwell, to help out on the boat. Paul had a range of duties which included putting the cushions out, preparing the tackle, tying it up at night, and washing it down. As well as that, he would steer the boat out of the harbour when Mountbatten wanted to go fishing. When Paul took the job, his father was concerned at first, but then realised that if somebody wanted to assassinate Mountbatten, they could do it in a different way, without harming children or those around him. The 60s and 70s were a very turbulent time in Northern Ireland. The level of violence was continuing to escalate, and violent attacks against Protestants and Catholics was an everyday occurrence. On one side, you had Irish nationalists fighting for a united Ireland. On the other side were Unionists who wanted Northern Ireland to remain in the United Kingdom. That being said, the violence was quite contained, and many people in the Republic of Ireland lived relatively normal lives. The IRA also initially avoided any attacks in the Republic of Ireland, as they didn't want the people of Ireland to turn against them. Though a request was sent to assassinate Mountbatten in the Republic in the 60s, it was rejected for this very reason. But by 1979, things had changed. Blood was flowing freely on the streets of Northern Ireland, and the IRA knew that the assassination of a member of the British royal family would make headlines around the world. They had also made significant technological advances in their bomb-making technology. At the start of the Troubles in the late 1960s, the IRA's method of bombing involved pouring petrol into milk bottles, lighting it on fire, and throwing it at British soldiers. They then moved on to fertilizer bombs, which were somewhat unreliable. Soon they were able to plant bombs that could be timed to explode weeks in advance, as is the case in the Brighton Hotel bombing, which nearly killed Margaret Thatcher. By 1979, the IRA in South Armagh had developed a radio-controlled bomb and had been using television shops in the Republic of Ireland to refine the making of these bombs. In response to these devices, the British Army set up a specific unit to target the new technology. They also built a network of radio stations which would hopefully find and jam the signals detonating the bombs. but it was impossible to detect each and every signal. They also usually weren't aware of the IRA's technological advances until an attack had occurred, and the IRA seemed to always be one step ahead of the British security forces. An ex-soldier said, "We generally discovered innovations, improvements in systems, only when a device had exploded or a device had in fact been recovered." At 79, many thought that Mountbatten was too old to be seen as a target by the IRA. He was just a peripheral character in the royal family, and as a result, he had less security around him while he was on holidays in Claiborne. In earlier years, the security was very strict, but Mountbatten was determined to lessen these measures, and by 1979, he just had two people directly assigned to protect him, with no one in charge of watching his boat, which was docked in the harbour at Mullaghmore. The English and Irish government both examined Mountbatten's security and came to the conclusion that there was no major threat to his life, allowing him to travel to Sligo in 1979. President of Sinn Féin at the time, Rory O'Brady, said of his yearly visits, "He was very, very ill-advised to be going there every August. What was he thinking about? What were his security advisors thinking about?" On the eve of the bombing, on August 26, 1979, Mountbatten, his family, and their bodyguards were in the castle and in good spirits. Meanwhile, two IRA men were down at the harbour being careful to avoid a routine patrol by local authorities. One kept lookout while the other snuck onto Mountbatten's boat and planted a 50-pound radio-controlled bomb. The main cabin in the boat was locked, but the engine at the back of the boat was open, and the bomb was placed there before the two men disappeared into the night. On the morning of Bank Holiday Monday, on August 27th, the bomb was primed and ready to go. It was a clear morning, and at 9:15 a.m, Mountbatten told his bodyguard that he would be going out on his boat with his family to do some sailing and check on their lobster pots. At 11:30 a.m, eight people boarded Shadow 5. They were Lord Mountbatten, his daughter Patricia and her husband John, their two sons, Nicholas and Timothy, John's mother, Lady Brabourne, and the local boy, Paul Maxwell. Mountbatten's bodyguard was watching the boat from the shore and following along in his car as it passed out of the harbour. Paul's father had travelled into town to buy a newspaper and waved to his son as he was heading out of the bay. This is the last time he would see his son alive. There was also a third person watching the boat. Somewhere along the coast, a man had his finger on the trigger of the radio-controlled bomb and watched the boat leave the bay. 5 minutes later, as the boat reached an inlet near Mountbatten's lobster pots, the trigger was pulled and the bomb exploded. Mountbatten's bodyguard described the explosion. Flashes of green, red, blue, and then suddenly a massive mushroom-shaped cloud of smoke. I remember saying, "Oh my God, no, this can't be happening. This hasn't happened." Paul Maxwell was standing on top of the bomb when it detonated and was killed instantly. Mountbatten was gravely injured in the bombing and was blown into the water. Initial reports said that Mountbatten was thrown into the water where he drowned, but it is now understood that he was pulled alive from the water by a local fisherman, but died from his injuries before they made it to shore. His legs were almost completely blown off. The boat itself was completely destroyed in the attack. The injured were lifted out of the water by local fishermen, who then brought them to shore. It has been reported that headboards from a nearby hotel were used as makeshift stretchers to carry the wounded off the beach, so that they could be rushed to the nearest hospital in the town of Sligo. 14-year-old Nicholas was killed in the blast, and 83-year-old Lady Brabourne also succumbed to her injuries the following day in hospital. Timothy, who lost his twin brother in the blast, said, "I remember a sensation, as if I'd been hit with a club, and a tearing sound. I don't remember my journey through the air or hitting the water." In his later life, Timothy went on to write a book about his experience on the day, called From a Clear Blue Sky. Shortly after the bombing, the IRA issued the following statement. "The IRA claim responsibility for the execution of Lord Louis Mountbatten. This operation is one of the discriminate ways we can bring to the attention of the English people the continuing occupation of our country. The death of Mountbatten and the tributes paid to him will be seen in sharp contrast to the apathy of the British government and the English people, to the deaths of over 300 British soldiers, and the deaths of Irish men, women, and children at the hands of their forces." Lord Mountbatten's biographer, Philip Ziegler, said of his death, "For Mountbatten, if he had gone alone, it was just about the perfect ending. He was nearly 80, he knew he was growing old, he was at sea, he was doing what he wanted most, he was blown up at sea by Her Majesty's enemies. He hit every headline in the world in dying. It was a magnificent end. The tragedy was that these other totally innocent members of his family went along with him. That would have caused him the deepest regret." Anthony McIntyre, a former IRA volunteer, said of the attack, "By the following day, when it was confirmed, there was a feeling of exhilaration. IRA volunteers and the hit squad which I was in were delighted, exhilarated, over the moon, that their volunteer comrades, on the other side, had punished the British state for the war crimes committed on Bloody Sunday. News of the attack spread quickly around the world and would lead to a political crisis between London and Dublin. But this was only the first of two devastating attacks that the IRA would commit on this day. 2 hours after the initial attack on Mountbatten, the IRA detonated another bomb in Warren Point, County Down, and killed 18 British soldiers. This attack, coupled with the attack on Mountbatten, were seen as two of the most devastating attacks in the history of the Troubles. Upon hearing news of the attacks, the Irish Prime Minister, or Taoiseach as it's called in Ireland, Jack Lynch, cut short his holiday and rushed back to Ireland. Meanwhile in London, Margaret Thatcher flew over to visit the injured soldiers and walk the streets of Belfast to show confidence in the government's control of the region, and reassure the people of Northern Ireland who supported her. She issued a statement saying, "By their actions today, the terrorists have added yet another infamous page to their catalogue of atrocity and cowardice." 2 weeks after the attack, Jack Lynch and members of the Irish Cabinet flew over to London to attend the funeral of Mountbatten. They were then summoned to Downing Street to meet with Thatcher, who demanded that they have better cross-border cooperation. At this point, members of the British Army were not allowed to chase suspected terrorists across the Northern Irish border into the Republic of Ireland. Thatcher wanted this to change, but Lynch would not allow it. Derek Nally, who was the secretary for the Irish government in 1979, reports that Lynch said to Thatcher, "You must appreciate, Prime Minister, that the repulsion in both countries is equal, but you are putting their blame on us. You cannot blame us because we have problems with the IRA just as you have problems. The IRA doesn't recognise our constitution. We have a problem that is at least as big as your problem." Soon to be president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, issued a statement saying, "The IRA gave clear reasons for the execution. I think it is unfortunate that anyone has to be killed, but the furor created by Mountbatten's death showed up the hypocritical attitude of the media establishment. As a member of the House of Lords, Mountbatten was an emotional figure in both British and Irish politics. What the IRA did to him is what Mountbatten has been doing all his life to other people. And with his war record, I don't think he could have objected to dying in what was clearly a war situation. He knew the danger involved in coming to this country. In my opinion, the IRA achieved its objective. People started paying attention to what was happening in Ireland. The investigation into Mountbatten's assassination proved to be very successful, unlike a lot of investigations that occurred during the Troubles. 2 hours before the bomb went off, Irish police arrested two men at an anti-terrorist checkpoint in the Republic of Ireland. The men were driving a red Ford Escort when a Garda stopped them. The Garda said that the driver seemed to be very nervous. Quote, "He seemed to lose full control of himself. I just knew there had to be something wrong with him. His hands were literally shaking. At this stage, I began to feel nervous myself." The men were brought into the local police station for questioning. One was Francis McGurl, and the other was Thomas McMahon, who was an experienced IRA bomber from South Armagh. By this stage, the bomb had gone off, but the officers deliberately didn't mention it to the two. Thomas McMahon proved to be very difficult to interview and answered very few of the questions. On the other hand, Francis McGurl was younger and more nervous than McMahon, so Gardaí focused their investigation on him. Back in Dublin, forensic scientists examined the boots of the two suspects. Traces of explosives were found on McMahon's clothing. As well as that, flecks of green paint were discovered on his boots, which were the same colour of paint as on Mountbatten's boat. As a result of this, McMahon was charged in court and was sentenced to 18 years for Mountbatten's murder. He was released in 1998 under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. This agreement brought peace to Northern Ireland for the first time in decades, and also saw the release from prison a number of people on both sides of the conflict who had engaged in politically motivated attacks. Because there was insufficient evidence to place McGurl at the scene, he was acquitted of all charges in 1980, but was later crushed to death by a tractor in a farm accident in 1995. The man who detonated the bomb has never been found. Paul Maxwell's father, John, said, "Thomas McMahon has to live with it, and you can rationalise your way out of the thing in terms of political aims and so forth, and talking about conventional wars and all that kind of thing. But I believe, anyhow, at the bottom of all that rationalisation somewhere, somewhere deep in the recesses of his mind, the horror of what he has done to my son must be there. In the years following this attack, there have been many tributes paid to Mountbatten. Prince William and Kate named their third son Louis in honour of him. Prince Charles also visited Mullaghmore in 2015 to pay tribute to his uncle. He was warmly greeted by the locals there during his visit and said, as a grandfather myself, I pray that his words can apply to all those who've been so hurt and scarred by the troubles of the past, so that all of us who inhabit these Atlantic islands may leave our grandchildren a lasting legacy of peace, forgiveness, and friendship." This assassination brought international attention to the conflict in Northern Ireland and led to both sides digging in deeper into their resolves. Since his release from prison, Thomas McMahon has refused to meet with Paul Maxwell's father, nor discussed his role in the bombing. Shortly before his release, his wife said, "Tommy never talks about Mountbatten, only the boys who died. He does have genuine remorse. Oh God, yes."